building sector. So, thank you very much for coming to this session. The air we breathe, an exploration of our radical materials and cooling techniques on that pollution. A slight change of maybe some of your books. You've noticed that Alison Pring was going to come over, who's connected with one of the projects upstairs, and works with a company called Made there, based in Berlin. Unfortunately, Alison had a family situation in which she couldn't come, but we do have another speaker. And rather, it's sort of serendipity that didn't realise that Bill Watts, senior partner at Max Fordham, is back quite connected with one of the projects upstairs, the one that involved concrete with mosses on. Bill will talk about that project and talk generally about some of the research development doing in this area. So let me say a little bit about three things as we go along, but perhaps a little bit of background to why today is today's topic, a pretty important topic. I think some of you will have doubtless sort of seen the headlines that by January the 5th, London had already breached its annual air pollution limit. And of course, you know, air pollution is connected with many pretty, pretty terrible diseases. It's estimated that nitrous oxide emissions could cause about 6,000 early deaths each year in the capital world. So that's pretty terrible stuff. Sadiq Khan has pledged, apparently, $875 million tackling the problem over 5 years. I don't know whether that's going to solve the problem in 5 years, or just what he's going to spread across the 5 years of spend. What are we going to do with that? And perhaps we'll learn some principles and priorities from this evening's discussion with our speakers. Because there are things you can do using materials to combat the problem, or maybe to help remove the problem from having in the first place. And there are materials out there, the products out there that are already doing certain things. I was surprised when we put it next to how many interesting things are out there, but how little adoption there has been in what would still obviously very straightforward, why did we use this? But things are actually much more complicated often than they look, and we'll hear a bit about that, I think, this evening. So what we're going to do, our speakers, each give a address, first two have some slides, Bill doesn't have slides, and then we'll take a panel, and we'll have a broad-ranging discussion, and you're very welcome to bring all your questions forward there. I think we'll take questions at that point rather than along the way, so that we can bring in each of the speakers on any relevant question at that point. A couple of things I should probably attend to. Just a reminder, there is another talk next week, our last talk in the series, From Labs to Prefabs. We have interesting speakers there, talking about how materials are changing the way we build cities and other aspects. So have a look at that online if you want to get more information about that. It's next Wednesday, same time, same place. What else do we should talk about today? So I should thank Trimo, by the way. Once again, Trimo sponsoring this session, sponsoring the whole event program. That's how the tickets can be available free. So big thanks to Trimo. You may want to make a mistake on your seat. At night time is the right time for competition. And if you're at all interested in how 24 hours is going to work, and you've got some thoughts on that subject, still not too late to get your entries to that competition. We've actually extended the deadline, so one more week to get an entry. Could simply be an idea on a sheet of paper. I mean, having made that simple, it'd be a brilliant, such a succinct idea. Otherwise, you might want to get more substantial, or you may have done a project in the past that is relevant to the other competitions. So please do look at that and consider it. Going to be a really interesting exhibition, and great talks about that coming up in late May through June. Amy Lowe, one of the architects from BIG, very lucky people on the judging panel at the competition. So it should be good. Now, our first speaker tonight. Charles Haswell. Charles just told me that I've got his bio slightly wrong. I've got a fascinating bio, and he's had like three careers. He is currently senior advisor at Cambridge Nanosystems. Before that, he was working with graphene stones. He'll talk about the graphene stones products doing for us. So he's worked on the largest anaerobic digestion project in England. His background, his previous career before getting into this area, was actually involving short order this way. Another phase, he worked in finance. So he possibly that was before that. great change to a fantastic new focus. So I'm going to hand over to Charlie with his focus on sustainability and new materials.
Thank you, Lewis. Well, thank you everybody for coming along tonight, and good evening and welcome. I should explain, you've also got me as a consultant for the Graphene Company. So just introduce, if I may, my colleagues from the Graphene Company in London. This is Patrick, who's the chief executive, and Francisco. They are responsible for graphene stone in this country, and I spent last year working with them. I've moved on now to Cambridge Nanosystems. Every now and again, I'm crossing a bridge in London, and I look up in the sky, and I have this look at two double slates, because I realize that actually, not that far above us, life is untenable. It can either be atmosphere, and there's no possibility of life. And actually, you can't dig very far into the ground to create a sustainable habitat either. So the actual space that we live in is tiny. If you take the Earth's land mass and imagine, take away the oceans, and just imagine the land mass and turn it into a rectangle, it's not very many thousand miles square, and it flies through space a bit like a magic carpet. So it is quite precious. Let's say we can't go very far into the Earth's surface to live, and we don't have to go up very far before we run out of life. So it's an extraordinary object. Sorry, this is going to be a bit slow. We call it home, but it's this little blue thing that floats through nothing. And what's really scary about it is that the layer that actually sustains us is incredibly thin. It's the thickness of that little blue line on the grey disk. That's how much we live in. So this is the air we breathe. What's interesting about the atmosphere is that it hasn't been the same at all. When we talk about climate change, the climate's always changed. I'm not saying that as a climate change skeptic, but the planet has changed enormously during its lifetime. So it's been around for 4.54 billion years. As you can see in the early days, lots of methane, ammonia, quite a lot of hydrogen, a lot of helium, surprisingly quite a lot of water vapor. Then you had this sort of spike in the Archean period of carbon dioxide. So there have been periods in the past when there was a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But actually what's interesting about that is that gave rise to the things that lived off carbon dioxide, plants, and started to generate oxygen. And it's oxygen that enables us to live. And as you can see from this, the carbon dioxide tails off, and it's, you know, for about a billion years, it's actually remarkably constant. The air is made up of things that are familiar, mostly nitrogen, nearly 80% nitrogen. You think we are oxygen life forms, we need an awful lot of oxygen. What's interesting is that much above about 23-24%, oxygen becomes toxic. It's not good for us. Things oxidize, you know, we take antioxidants because they make us better. But also things combust more easily, so you get quite a dangerous sort of planet. So this balance between nitrogen and oxygen is really quite delicate. And then you've got these other things. As you can see, I mean, carbon dioxide is actually not that high, but we know the impact that it has on the atmosphere. What I'm going to pick out just from this is methane. For those of you not familiar with the chemical formula, and I wasn't until a short while ago, CH4, one carbon atom to four hydrogen atoms. It's 30 times worse than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. And so the reason that they flare it at oil fields is so that instead of releasing methane into the atmosphere, they release carbon dioxide because it's not quite so damaging. That's not really very good science. So we're doing our best to mess up that balance. A lot of the things that we do are pushing carbon into the atmosphere and making it an awful lot worse. Picture at the top right there, that's the oil sands in Alberta. Anybody familiar with the oil sands in Canada, that's flaring methane. As I say, they're doing that because the carbon dioxide that pushes out into the atmosphere is not as damaging as they think it is for methane. I mentioned in that earlier slide that you've got a relatively flat level of carbon dioxide. That was a sort of low greeny-yellow band along the bottom. Just recently, it's shot up rather dramatically. I don't know if any of you have seen our Gold Gore's Inconvenient Truth, but he makes quite a lot of that particular graph. I take a view that climate change has actually been happening for a very long time. Glaciers have been receding for a very long time. There are things called Milankovitch cycles, which some of you might know about. Essentially, the Earth wobbles. Sometimes it leans more towards the sun, sometimes it leans away. sometimes it rotates closer to the sun and sometimes it rotates further away. And so the climate has been changing for a long time, but there is good evidence that it's us with our carbon dioxide that's beginning to have a real impact. And there is a clear link between global temperature, global warming, and the presence of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. I mentioned earlier that at a point in the Earth's history, there was a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So nature evolved and became sustainable by making use of that. It devised ways of capturing the carbon and fixing it into structures, into things that were useful, things like trees. And that carbon is fixed for a long time. We take it out as coal, but of course we then start burning it and releasing the carbon again. The byproduct that I mentioned here is actually the byproduct of photosynthesis. It was that generation of oxygen that I talked about earlier that makes complex life forms like us possible. So if we're going to sort this out, we've got to try and find a way of mimicking nature, that ability to take carbon out of the atmosphere and fix it and do something useful with the products. So we need to be able to create stable structures. It'd be useful to have a usable byproduct. Obviously, photosynthesis, the byproduct is oxygen. But the key to all of this is graphene. And I'm sure everyone in this room has heard about graphene, knows a little bit about graphene. Graphene in its pure form is a layer, hexagonal web of carbon atoms, just one atom thick. It was discovered in Manchester, or isolated first in Manchester in 2004. 13 years ago. It is interesting, when carbon fiber was first developed, it took 30 years to turn it into usable things, into composites and so on. So you might ask why it's taken so long to take graphene and put it into usable things. Well, we're beginning to accelerate that process, and I'll come on to that. But graphene has extraordinary properties. So it's transparent, it's inert, it's water repellent. You might have seen a thing in the press about 3 weeks ago about how they've just developed a graphene oxide filter for seawater. So you literally filter seawater and you get pure drinking water. It's a very effective thermal conductor and a super electrical conductor. It's also 200 times stronger than steel, but it's light, it's flexible, it's hard. If we can really use it in buildings and in the built environment, it is pretty much a perfect material. The first company that actually made graphene available in a commercial form was Graphenstone. And these are coatings which actually took one of the traditional materials, lime, which is breathable, which is natural, but not necessarily terribly strong, and put graphene in it to give it strength. And those have been available in this country for about a year. About a year ago, and there's a full range of paints and coatings and so on. The point about lime-based paints is when you put them on the wall, they start reabsorbing the carbon dioxide you cooked out of the lime in the first place. So it actually breathes in carbon dioxide, it takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So we're at the beginning of what I call a new age of materials that are intrinsic to a healthy environment. We talked about nitrous oxides earlier. Graphenstone also produce coatings which shield electromagnetic radiation. Very useful for children's bedrooms, mobile phones and things. But also which actually take nitrous oxides out of the atmosphere through a catalytic process. Now as we see more and more of these kind of materials, then architects are going to be able to take advantage of all these different things that are available. And actually build buildings which get back to my point earlier of helping the atmosphere to recover, helping take the carbon out of the atmosphere. I mentioned just a few things, but actually, as many of you will know, graphene has an almost infinite number of uses. And here's just a few things that I'll focus on. I talked about coatings. Paints, there's a company in Canada that's producing coatings to paint on buoys at sea because they don't corrode. You're seeing them beginning to be used in concrete additives, so they bring lightness and strength to concrete, so we'll see ever more fantastic, light, airy structures that are stronger than the previous versions. Fireproofing is quite new. Some of you might know that there's the tallest wooden building in the world is going up in London, a 7-story wooden building, but it has to be fireproofed. So Cambridge Nanosystems, which is the company that I'm working with, has actually produced a graphene coating which fireproofs the timber. Composites, polymers, all these things. I should go back for a moment. That lattice you saw of carbon atoms is not necessarily how graphene appears in all its uses. Most graphene is produced in platelets and little particles. But when you mix these particles into polymers or into composites, you get the properties of the graphene coming through in the finished material. So nobody's making an enormous sheet of graphene that could fill this room, for example. That's not possible technologically at the moment. But nor is it necessary, because the graphene platelets and graphene particles will have the same properties. But you're seeing, for example, bicycle tires. Vittorio, which is an Italian company, is using graphene in its tires. Some of you may know about carbon black. The carbon black industry in the world is about a $56 billion industry. Carbon black is vital to car tires, rubber hoses, anything that uses rubber. It strengthens it. It's a coloring agent. Graphene is a straight substitute for carbon black, so you're immediately looking at an economically substitutable alternative. So you're immediately looking at an industry for graphene of about $56 billion there. What graphene brings to tyres, as well as the strength, is its thermal conductivity. So any of you who follow Formula One will know that Pirelli have been having trouble with their tyres. It's quite a spectacular blowout in the bottom right-hand corner there. When Pirelli start putting graphene in their tyres, not only will you get the additional strength of the graphene, but you'll get the heat distribution, which has been the main problem. The tyres will stop blowing up. When you start using those tyres on your vehicles, they will just last an awful lot longer now. Some of the tyre industry might not like that, but that is one of the ways in which we can start to conserve materials. You get sensors. This wrist here, that's actually a sensor for diabetics. So instead of having to test regularly and so on, you can simply wear something on your wrist and the sensors will pick up your blood sugar and tell you when you need to make some adjustments. And some of you may have seen, there was a piece in the Financial Times recently about hydrogen cars. Obviously there's two schools of thought on this. One is electric vehicles, that's the Elon Musk school of thought, where you have batteries. And battery technology will at some point get better, they will get lighter and they will have longer range. But there's also the hydrogen technology, which is about fuel cells. And the Toyota Mirai, which you can buy, I don't think it's available in this country, but they're manufacturing them in Japan at the moment, has two hydrogen tanks and a fuel cell and a backup battery, and it's basically an electrical vehicle. Its exhaust is water. One of the problems around one of the problems around hydrogen as a fuel source is storing it, because it leaks through things. One thing it doesn't leak through is graphene. So if you build your hydrogen tanks out of carbon fiber composite using graphene, you can build a safe storage system for hydrogen. It then runs on, the technologies run on through, because if you use graphene for the electrodes within the fuel cell, you enormously increase the current capacity of the fuel cell. So you can see how these technologies will continue to reinforce each other. And if you thought that was clever, here comes the clever bit. Some of you may know what a plasma is. I'm not talking about blood plasma, I'm talking about plasma as a material. Plasma is actually the fourth state of matter. So you're familiar with solids, liquids, and gases. And beyond a gas, there is plasma. And what happens in a plasma is that the electrons break free from molecules and from atoms and from molecules, and effectively you get a soup of ions and electrons. So you can break up gases in a plasma. Now some of you may know of some of the experiments going on with plasma technology at the moment. So the thing called the Joint European Torus at Cullen, which is an attempt to produce fusion power, that runs very hot plasmas. They have to be held in place by superconducting magnets. So you have a superconducting magnet which has to be at absolute zero, about a foot from plasma, which is several thousand degrees hot. So the technology is difficult, very difficult. But there are other ways of producing plasmas. And one is you can use microwaves. And when I say microwaves, I'm talking about the same kind of magnetron as you have in your microwave at home in the kitchen, just a bit more powerful. But you can crack methane using microwaves. And this is what Cambridge Nanosystems has done. This is the technology that they've developed. We'll go back to that point that methane was CH4. So what the microwaves do is take the worst of the greenhouse gases and split it into graphene and hydrogen, which is an energy source. So you get something looking a bit like this. What comes out at the end of this process, you start, let's say, with the worst of the greenhouse gases, and you get graphene as a material, and then hydrogen as your energy source. So we can do this. We can fix the carbon, rather like nature fixed the carbon from carbon dioxide. We can fix the carbon from methane, and then we release hydrogen as a pure energy source. Lots of people talk about the need to cut down on carbon, talk about the low carbon economy. Carbon is our enemy. Actually, graphene means carbon is our ally. In future, we won't talk about low carbon economies, we'll talk about carbon efficient economies. So you are seeing the future here. What you're also seeing is the long-term sustainability.